logic issues. And as a neurologist, I bring a particular perspective to this because it's part of my daily practice to deal with people who have strokes, and dementia, and Parkinson's disease, and intractable migraine headaches that can't be cured by any of the drugs that I try. And so people spend a great deal of time talking about what happens to the brain. And I think what it has finally left me with is, and I want to talk about it as a general principle and not get into what each lesion in the brain might cause, because that is a week-long seminar and a lot of neuroanatomy and everybody'd be asleep by the time I got started. But I want to talk about a real general principle. Rick had alluded to a little bit earlier about the genetic and evolutionary history of our species. And the cheetah has its speed, the bear has its strength. We have this central nervous system as our evolutionary advantage. It's what makes us a successful species. And what does it do? In the main, what our brain does is run a simulation exercise constantly, 24/7. If this, then that. If this, then that. If this, then that. If that, then something else. And if this happens. And it runs it and runs it and runs it. How does that make us successful? It means that when we meet a stimulus in the environment, we have already set up a programmed set of responses to deal with that stimulus. So we know what to do when something falls out. We're not in this immediate reactive approach avoidance. We actually have a whole battle plan to handle the fact that somebody has jumped out from behind the tree. It, to some extent, gets heisted by the Velcro for negative, Teflon for positive. We're always going to assume that curved thing in the path is a snake and not a stick. But at the same time, it's incredibly successful. And it's allowed us to work. Now, where's the suffering comes in? Everybody here has woken up at 3:00 in the morning and had the simulation machine running on overtime of what she said, what he said, what I was supposed to do, and the taxes haven't been paid, and this injury has happened, and I've lost this, this whole story that runs and runs and runs. It's a property of the brain. We can't wish it away. It came with the 46 chromosomes that made you. In addition, and this is sort of a kind of my son of sidebar on karma. Karma, in terms of causes and consequences, I do something, therefore something happens, is pretty easy to see in the real world. I drop my glasses, they hit the ground. I mean, they break.
My microphone drops.
And I've just engendered a great deal of karma for myself in the last 5 seconds. That's a real life example of karma. So that can be played out in just as you think about it in terms of your interactions with other people. Well, there's a genetic karma that you inherit, which is that if you look at some research on personality characteristics and genetic endowment, there's some interesting work that's come out of adopted out twin studies, identical twins adopted out out of Minnesota, where they actually kept some fairly decent records on all this. And perhaps somewhere between 20% and 40% of your personality characteristics came with the chromosome set that you got. And that means that can be some very important kinds of things. Your tendency to anger, your tendency for risk behavior, your tendency for depression or elation may be things that came with the package. And part of the whole question about second dart is to not add, I should be otherwise, to that package. So in the self-compassion exercise, understand part of that is an exercise in working on who you are. What is this that is me? And accepting that and just saying, that's what came in. Now, let's take this into a real life situation. You have a personal history. That genetic inheritance got dropped into a particular family structure, was educated in a particular way, chose particular paths in life, had or did not have children. took particular careers, made a left turn at the intersection versus a right turn at the intersection, resulting in a motor vehicle accident or not. All of those kinds of things have happened to you through your life. Interestingly enough, the genetics, because it codes largely for receptor chemistry in the brain and how the dopamine receptors are modified and the serotonin receptors are modified, that can actually be modified by experiences, including the self-experiences that Rick just led you through, in terms of inducing hormonal changes in the brain, inducing transmitter changes in the brain. So your genetics is a little bit modified. However, most of our suffering that brings us in not to just spiritual experiences, but brings us into the therapist office, is a great deal of exercises in wishing for a better past. You got the joke. The past has happened. I can't take back the fact that I dropped the glasses on the dais and turned my microphone off at the same time. That's an event. It's now in my memory and in the memory of everybody else here. That past is written down in some kind of sense in neurons having fired together and wired together and established a connection of sequence. What's not written down and what is malleable is how that past is held. We could either hold my dropping the glasses and turning off my microphone as a tremendous insult to the privilege of sitting up on the teacher's seat at Spirit Rock and being able to talk about the Dharma. And Mendius is just really this terrible teacher because he turned his microphone off and I couldn't hear what he had to say. Or we can treat it as it was treated, as kind of a humorous exercise in the fallibility of human beings, which is how I intended it. That's important to see. And so how you take those past events and hold them into the next moment is real critical. The past is done. The words are said. The words are understood. The future, the next word I'm going to say in the sentence after this one, isn't here yet. None of those things are written. The only moment that is happening is right now is the 50 to 200 millisecond mind moment of your central nervous system receiving and processing these auditory stimuli right now. That's the moment that exists. That is and in that moment is the level of control and free will over what's going to happen in the next moment. And there's solid neuroscience truth to suggest that. So we take a brain that has a particular genetic endowment. It has particular kinds of lesions from attention deficit disorder, from a bad background, from trauma, from torture, from loss, from grief, from a stroke that's taken out your language ability, or from strokes that have taken out much more subtle abilities. And then you move it into the next moment. I want to tell you a little story to sort of illustrate that has a meditation flavor. A patient of mine comes in with a right frontal stroke, and he goes through his hospitalization. He has a little bit of a left-sided weakness, a little bit of a left facial problem, some gait problems. Those actually resolve within a short space of time, and the patient and his wife come back in about 2 to 3 months later for a follow-up visit. Both of them are meditators. Both of them are highly connected, long-standing, strong marriage. The patient is actually feeling very much that his meditations are stronger, that he has more capability of focus, that he has a greater pleasure in his sitting practice. His significant other is bereft because in some funny, interesting ways, he is just not there for her in the way he used to be. He is not speaking in quite the same quality. He is not communicating the same kind of emotional connectedness that he had before. So here is this very interesting dynamic of a small focal stroke in the frontal lobe, which has amazing consequences for the meditator, the patient with the stroke, who's feeling that he's actually better able to focus and in tune, and my Zafu hours are really cool. And the wife who's saying, he isn't there. I don't feel him anymore. I've lost. You know, and yet he's there, and yet his words are the same, and he's expressing the same internal emotional state, but I'm not getting it. It's not resonating. And that's the story. I think I've actually told the story in this seminar the previous time because it had just happened. Well, in the way of fortunate events, it just happened this week. They came back, and over the ensuing year, he is actually rediscovered how to communicate those statements. He actually doesn't notice that he's doing much, but they have worked it out so that those same attunements, those same communications are occurring. So on the one hand, you can look at this from the standpoint of a stroke and say here is focal loss. And on the other hand, you can look at this later story and say, here's this focal loss with the actual absence of the neuronal tissue that is going to give your language emotional expression. Because that's what he lost. The ability to make the distinction verbally between the sentence, did you go downtown? And the sentence, you go downtown? Those are remarkably different sentences as we understand them. They are grammatically identical. That inflection, that prosodic, that melodic quality of our language is what's involved in the right frontal lobe, and is part of what makes us our communications so much more than what we actually say. And then here's the heroic story, which actually gives faith to all of these processes. That when you sit there and you say, give myself compassion. And I'm telling myself the negative side story of why should it give me compassion? And it immediately shows up, me, the schmuck. But drop by drop by drop by drop by drop, this can be changed. You can allow the nervous system to recreate and to redo this process and create different behaviors. So ultimately, with these things, there are things that you can do. So this simulation machine that we live in, which is an incredibly, the other piece that I really want to leave you with, another statement on the brain, is that it is a chaotic electrodynamic state. It basically sits there, and all kinds of things are potential at the moment, depending upon a Darwinian competition for circuitry in the brain of what's got the greatest neuronal involvement at this 50 millisecond or 200 millisecond mind moment. And then there's kind of a clearing, and then the next mind moment happens. It's sort of like an old Charlie Chaplin movie. Frame, 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 frame. It's very unstable. There really is, as Rick and I pointed out in the last chapter of the book, there really is no there. This is there's a circuit that gives you the illusion of a continuous self that links all those frames and says, I'm me, I'm all those frames going back 59 and 10 and a half months. And they're all linked in sort of this illusion of what I remember. But that it's really very unstable. And that it's unstable and that it changes very, very rapidly. On the one hand, that's scary, because here you are on a high wire, 5,000 feet over Yosemite Valley, and you're in hiking boots. What are you doing up there? But at the same time, flip that. Here is this incredible creative moment where as this mind moment dissolves and disappears into nothingness and past memory and becomes irretrievable, in this dissolution of that mind moment is the possibility, by inculcating and working habits of mind, to create a more positive evocation into the next mind moment. That's literally what we are given as a central nervous system by the way this simulation machine evolved. Now, some of the exercises we've done so far have been things that kind of require a Zafu cushion. they kind of require a little bit of time. What I want to talk about here is something, a couple of practices that will allow you to avoid being hijacked. I mean, there was a beautiful evocation of someone who's lost his life partner about, you know, 10 to 15 times a day, I believe that's what you'd said. 10 to 15 times a day, you get punched in the gut by the emptiness, that the absence of that person literally in the universe brings to mind. I've been, personal story, I also lost a spouse to cancer, and I had a very amazing sort of epiphanic moment for me, which was 2 days later, I was driving down the 101 freeway coming south, and all of a sudden realized that the view of Mount Tam didn't have Catherine in it anymore. That there was no Catherine to could even potentially have seen that mountain. And it, fortunately for me, there'd been enough practice that it carried with the two things. One was the sense of loss, and the other was the real gut level realization of the term emptiness and what that means. The dharmic statement about emptiness, that out of which everything arises and back to which it disappears. Now here's this emptiness. It is both a loss and an incredibly generative state, because new things arise. Without clearing the ground, you can't have new crops. And that is just a fact of existence. So how do we deal with the fact that when something like this happens and we get, bam, punched in the gut by something, or we get hijacked by a negative statement about ourselves, how do we stop that? Because there are consequences in that second dart that happen in the brain. And the consequences are, if you overactivate the sympathetic nervous system, it stimulates the hypothalamus to run the pituitary, to run the adrenal gland, to secrete cortisol. Cortisol is a neurotoxin. You take people under constant stress conditions. You can do this with animals, and it's also been done in individuals who are placed under conditions of torture. And what happens to the hippocampus? It shrinks. Well, what about the hippocampus? So a little bit of neuroanatomy. You've got two hippocampi, one on the left and one on the right. They're responsible for your random access memory. How you get to and from memory circuits is dependent on your hippocampus being healthily functioning in a healthy condition. And a large part of the hippocampus functioning healthy is that there's a good bit of it. You know, hippocampal atrophy is not a positive thing. You restrict the quality of your memory access. You restrict what you're able to see. Constant chronic exposure to cortisol causes hippocampal atrophy. Constant reiteration and running that circuit of he did, she did, he said, she said, oh, how it could be, the 97-year-old woman, why me? Running that damages your brain, causes cortical atrophy, causes in not just the hippocampus, but in multiple other areas of the brain, and is not something you want to do. So there is neuroanatomic basis for the dharmic second dart story, that the second darts that we fling at ourselves in terms of the terrible story about this negative sensation, I shouldn't have it, or look what happened to me, those second darts actually damage brain if we run them again and again and again. And you can see this in post-traumatic stress disorder. You can see this in survivors of incest. You can see this in survivors of stroke who are depressed and running the what happened to me kind of stories. And some of that's anatomical. You can have a stroke that actually damages your ability to have a positive relationship to your future life. So that has consequences to the brain. It's very critically important, to the extent possible, that you attempt to not do the second dart story. I mean, this is the dharmic version of stop smoking. You're going to cause damage to self. How do you do that? Well, in You know, in the way of the central nervous system, you know, I may misquote this, but in terms of the wheel of dependent origination starts with ignorance. So coming to a conference like this and establishing your frame of reference so that you understand how your life is occurring and who you actually are, so that you're no longer ignorant about what life is like. What is, you know, that dukkha is a fact of existence. You know, that the suffering or stress of just trying to maintain homeostasis, just trying to maintain yourself in a consistent glucose level, requires that you're always moving a little bit more, a little bit less. You're always trying to rebalance. That's dukkha. But that's just existence. So starting from eradicating ignorance. And then there's a lot of other things in there. But then you come to that contact with a stimulus, a feeling arises, and then craving of some kind, approach or avoidance, or next stimulus please, occurs. That's where you can actually cut this link. And that's where actually, in terms of the craving piece, where the second dart story, that's where the sympathetic nervous system gets enacted. That's where your stress arises. So let's talk about some things that you could do to interdict that real time, driving down the freeway, somebody cuts you off. The first is to establish, I think, a frame of relative safety and security. You can practice this when you take up your seat for meditation. You can establish a sense of safety in the surroundings. If you're here in the room, you can establish a sense of safety. You're among good people. The story we've told several times in our daylongs is that if you look at the traditional instructions for going to meditate, you're to take up a place of seclusion, you know, in the forest or a cave. The Buddha's story about his night of enlightenment, the Bodhi tree had his back. He took his seat under the tree with the trunk to his back. All the forces of Mara, all of the temptation of Mara's daughters, all of the threats of Mara's soldiers, all of that stuff in the story happens in front of him where he has the hands and the dexterity to deal with it. So that's a part of the meditation practice. So in your life, establishing some kind of sense of personal security if at nothing else, I'm a living human organism with the right to be here right now. And that allows me the security of my inheritance to deal with this situation, however horrific it may be. That at least establishes you a foundation. It's a place from which you can stand. And the second thing is to use the breath, which I think is a phenomenal kind of deal. And I'll talk about three practices. The first is parasympathetic activation using the breath. If you inhale, you take in your breath, actually that increases the sympathetic charge. And you can kind of feel that. It's just everybody take a nice deep in-breath. Feel yourself get ready. You feel that energy kind of come in as you take in that oxygen. There's actually a sympathetic activation, kind of an increase in heart rate. There's a readiness. There's a shifting of blood on the inhale from actually the different parts of the body, depending upon context. If that inhalation is taken in a moment of fear, the shift is to the quadriceps and gastrocnemius muscles in the legs to run like hell. If that inhale is happening in a moment of anger, bam, biceps, pectoralis, I'm going to nail them. You can feel that in very subtle ways, depending upon what your emotional tenor is. So that's the sympathetic side. Now, the sympathetic side is actually what we don't want to have, because that comes into telling story. That comes into running this, you know, this top 40 riff about what is happening to me. So what do I want to do? I want to activate the parasympathetic side. So what do I do? You let go. Exhalation is a parasympathetic activation. Exhalation drops your blood pressure, lowers your heart rate, decreases the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis stimulation. It's actually just real time. So there, you know, there's this, there are a bunch of these little kind of vignettes that go out there. You know, the three breath meditation. You're driving down the freeway, something happens. It's just three deep breaths, concentrating on the outflow, on the exhalation, and just watch what happens. Let's just do that right now. So everybody, sit for a minute. Bring yourself into kind of a comfortable position. Take whatever emotion has been happening to you listening to me ramble on up here. Now, I want you to have the chair or the room at your back. Bring that sense of security, of being among good people and engaged in good work. And now take a slightly deeper breath and let it go. And another breath. And a final breath. And just for a second now, just feel how your nervous system is resonating with all the other more relaxed, resonating nervous systems in the room. Isn't that amazing? The whole energy of the room comes down. Now, there is something that can be done quickly, that can be done in the context of renewing yourself to trying to struggle with whatever wound brought you here. That's something that you can use to gain a little balance so that you can have some more self-compassion. It takes that sympathetic nervous system charge away. It protects your brain from more cortisol from your adrenal glands. And it's easily portable. That's the nice thing. You don't need a Zafu. You do three breaths anywhere you are. You're going to breathe anyway. If not, well, then you won't have to worry. the other piece that always strikes me when I talk about breath work is that in all spiritual traditions, the breath is actually thought of as one of the portals to spiritual enlightenment. And why is that? And I think my own take on it, it is one of the few autonomic housekeeping nervous system activities over which we as human beings have voluntary control to some extent. So there is really right there the interaction between will structure. I have the will to say something, I'm going to use my breath. I'll hold my breath till I turn blue. All this kind of will stuff that happens. And the involuntary structure, which is that the breath runs itself anyway. So the whole contemplation of the breath as spiritual practice is really interacting at that point where will structure meets the uncontrollable, and where you really come up against the fact that your life is really not really quite of your own making, that you're kind of along for the ride. And the use of breath work, as we just did, use like sympathetic and parasympathetic system, can actually do a lot of things towards restructuring your stress level. I'm not going to take you through the second exercise, which is based on heart math work, which is heart rate variability. The other system that's tremendously affected by the autonomic nervous system, or one of the other systems, obviously, is heart rate and blood pressure. And increasing variability in heart rate and in blood pressure is a hallmark of sympathetic overactivation. And it turns out that is a way of activating both as a relaxation of conscious stress and anxiety and as a relaxation of the autonomic nervous system is to do the heart math kind of process. And there is another way of using breath actually to entrain another autonomically nervous system run piece, which is pulse rate. And the way to do this is to make your inhalation and your exhalation equal. And you know, whereas if you're concentrating on the parasympathetic side, the three breaths we just did before, that's because you're overcharged and you really just want to drop the parasympathetic right now. But say you wanted to just do this as more of a regular process, is to sit and just you bring yourself into and make the inhalation and the exhalation the same length, perhaps by using a gentle counting method. Say counting to four slowly in on the inhale, counting to four slowly on the exhale. And then I'll do I'll run you through that, and then at the end I'll give you the final, very quick way of relaxing the parasympathetic nervous system, but I'll give it to you as a surprise because it's fun. So take up your seat. And bring yourself into a position of erect, relaxed dignity. If there are areas of obvious muscle tension in your shoulders or your neck or your back or somewhere else in your body, just consciously let that go. No need to add to the suffering of your life anymore for this few minutes of time. And bring your attention to your breath. Wherever it's happening for you. And I would like you to deepen your breath slightly by imagining that you're breathing into the bottom of your belly and filling your entire trunk from the bottom all the way up to the top with each inhale. Filling out the belly, expanding the chest, all the way to fullness, and then letting it out. Two or three more breaths in this fashion. And now I'd like you to inhale and exhale in equal time. Inhale, 2, 3, 4. Exhale, 2, 3, 4. Inhale, 2, 3, 4. Exhale, 2, 3, 4. Inhale, 2, 3. Exhale, 2, 3, 4. And continue in this fashion. Paying attention to the breath. letting all of the stress of your life slide in and out on the breath. Deeply calming, deeply relaxing. And now, very gently, bring your right index finger up to your lip and make blubbery noises. I think that last one works because it's impossible to maintain a pompous adult presence while doing that. It actually also helps with oxytocin and is actually a very deeply parasympathetically relaxing piece. And with that, questions, comments before lunch? We're right about on 12:25. Yes.
I have a question about something Rick Benson mentioned before. You talked about, and I don't know if I can get exactly the answer.
Do we have the mic?
Yeah.
I'll talk louder.
No.
Check. You talked about that very quick anxiety, terror response when you're feeling good. It's in the mind, it's in the adrenals, it's in the nose and the toes. Could you talk more about that and practice to resolve that? Just thinking about it.
Yeah, so I think that relates to what Rick said there, and he may add a comment too, that we have the systems in ourselves, typically the sympathetic nervous system intertwining with an endocrine system that activates really quickly. And the interesting thing about it is that it wears off really slowly, because a lot of what it surges through us are neurochemicals that are still in the blood. Have you ever had a situation where you thought something horrible had happened or was about to happen, and then even quickly you discovered that it didn't happen at all? It really turned out okay. And yet the body is still twitchy 20 minutes later, right? That's because it takes a while to metabolize all that stuff. So to your question, it is very interesting that often it makes us frightened to feel a little safer. Or we get worried when we start to feel good, very often because in our history, it's after we felt good that we got nailed. Maybe because when we were a kid, we would feel good, we would get exuberant, a little da-da, and then that's when they would hit us, maybe. Or there's a sense that if you lower your guard, you know, that's when they'll jump out and get you, which is exactly, I think, what you're getting at. Right. And I think there's several things to do about it, and then maybe Rick will add. First is to have a kind of compassion for oneself at the purposefulness of it. In other words, paradoxically, when we honor these parts of ourselves, when we befriend our inner crocodile, you know, our inner snake, our inner monkey, when we befriend those parts of us, they actually become less powerful, paradoxically. So when we appreciate these survival systems and make friends with them, they're not so intense. That for me has been one thing. A second thing is to really appreciate what in psychology is called defense analysis, and the idea, or psychotherapy, the idea that defenses are there for a reason. And it's very important to kind of respect them and to not just knock them all down. You know, in other words, if there's a reaction of anxiety toward feeling good or safe, it's there for a reason. So there's a place of understanding it and appreciating its function. And then the point is to replace it with a more sophisticated way to accomplish the same result. You know, I think the nature of wisdom very much in the Dharma is to give up a lesser pleasure for a greater one, to give up a lesser reward for a greater reward, a lesser good for a greater good. In other words, that's true in our mind as well. Very often what the brain and the mind do is create these very, in psycholingo, primitive coping mechanisms that got us through then, right? But then we need to move on to another more sophisticated one, another one that's more benevolent and has fewer harms. And it reminds me of the metaphor from the Buddha of the raft, right? That we're faced with a river of suffering, so we construct a raft to get across to the other side. But once we're on the other side, we set down that particular raft, right? And then we keep going. Same thing, you know, the brain creates these rafts to get us through, to get us through our childhood, to get us through summer camp, to get us through grade school, you know, to get us through junior high, whatever it is, or to get us through some traumatic moment. Okay, but then when we get to the other side, as we move on the path of awakening, let's set that particular raft down and then build more sophisticated ones. Right. And then the last thing I would say is I think the felt sense of someone with us is incredibly important. You know, that's where that affiliation system research really, really goes to the heart of being human.
Right.
That we are not crocodiles or ants. I mean, it's deeply important to us to have a felt sense that others are with us. And, you know, in psych language, the internalized objects or internalized others. And activating that felt sense of being with others or having others with one who love and care about us, even if in a very spiritual sense, you know, the divine loves and cares about us wherever we go, or our own deepest nature is positive and benign. Whatever that is, that's I guess, the final thought I would have for the moment about how to help ourselves increasingly release unnecessary anxiety and turn more to life with a sense of confidence, but also the peace that comes from, as James said earlier, quoting Joseph Goldstein, the absolute understanding that everything could fall apart in the next moment. And to be at peace with that and to meet that next moment with a smile and an open hand, to me that's the best odd strategy for getting through life, and it's a wonderful way to be.
I think the only thing I'd add is that mindfulness is the antidote to that. If you think about what the service of that agitation, if one's feeling good, what does that serve? It is to remind the organism to not relax. In the sense that you escape the tiger, well, maybe the tiger's still there, so you need to check. You don't want to relax too early. You also don't want to continue it too long. So it's actually, in a sense, kind of a wake-up call to be mindful, literally at a neurochemical hormonal level, just in the same kind of, and so it's in a sense a way to remind you to kind of practice in that next mind moment. To be aware of what's arising, so that okay, tiger's gone, man, check the room, no more tiger, good. Now we can invoke relaxation practices. So then you have the control over to take other skillful means, to take other kinds of techniques, whatever works for you as an individual, into the next mind moment to calm the waters and to move skillfully into the next piece of your life.
I had one more thing I'd like to add very quickly on that, which is. There's a term in psychology called signal anxiety. It's the idea that anxiety operates as a signal us. So the problem, though, is that just to stay alive in the wild, the brain is constantly generating this little low-grade trickle of anxiety. It's like an annoying drip, You know what I mean? Late at night when you're trying to sleep, just drip, drip, drip. Try to walk across this room when we take our lunch break in a moment without any anxiety whatsoever as we move across the room, you know, including meeting someone in the eyes, let's say. And it's really hard. Mm-hmm. The problem is that to keep us alive, the brain basically wants to make, it's willing to make the same mistake 99 times to avoid making the one mistake once. In other words, it's willing to think there's a tiger there when there really isn't 99 times to make sure that it notices the tiger that's really there.
Right.
And so much of the anxiety trickle in us is meaningless. And that's an interesting way to relate to it, to start to appreciate the meaninglessness of most anxiety. Right. It's not meaning, it doesn't carry any information. There's no signal, right? It's ubiquitous.
Right.
And starting to appreciate that, we start to realize that we don't need to react to the anxiety that's internally generated. When the body is sick, when the body has been injured, when there's been a brain trauma, let's say, or any other difficult condition, anxiety continually pulses, even though, honestly, the tiger bit us already and is long gone. Right? But we're still getting anxious. To start to appreciate anxiety as a kind of arbitrary and meaningless body sensation, increasingly, is wonderfully freeing.
A good book on this to kind of understand some of it is Sapolsky's book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. It basically, and he talks about the relationship between that kind of species, which doesn't, because they actually don't have that simulation machine running, and primates who do. And the cost in suffering of anxiety, of having a simulation machine as your tapioca pudding between your ears, in terms of what it means to you downstream.
Maybe one more, and then we should move to lunch.
Could you just comment on this afternoon's program? What we will be doing?
Sure. So the question was, what are we doing this afternoon? And you know, in including